Hello, friends, and welcome to the Healing Ground Movement. Now, for more content and bonus features, you can join us on Facebook and Instagram. And remember, all of our content is delivered freely, so please consider supporting the show by donating via the link on our website at healinggroundmovement.com or liking and reviewing the podcast on your favorite platform.
Enjoy today's episode.
Hey, everyone. Today's episode is brought to you by ButcherBox. ButcherBox partners with people who are dedicated to doing the right thing, never cutting corners and always looking for ways to improve. Discover why they're the trusted source of high-quality protein for families across the country. At ButcherBox, they believe in better. For them, that means caring about their animals and the planet, treating our planet with respect. It means improving the lives of animals and the livelihoods of farmers, and ultimately, it means better meals enjoyed together. The protein from ButcherBox is never given antibiotics or added hormones. It's humanely raised. Our family loves the convenience and quality and knowing that we are getting humanely raised and sustainably harvested protein. You can customize your box with the right amount of food and variety of meat to fit your family's individual needs. If you're interested in getting a special offer, go ahead and head to healinggroundmovement.com/resources to follow the link for ButcherBox. Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Healing Ground Movement. I am your host, Dr. Carly Hudson, and with us today, we have Arli, and we are going to take a really fun, broad conversation about connection and intention and relationship and community and how all of that really boils down to coming back to our health, because after all, we're in a movement for better health here. Arli is an advisor and strategist of mental health and entrepreneurship and policy and a relationship coach and mentor. To her, they are really the same thing. The well-being of an organization or community and the well-being of a marriage or relationship is predicated upon a healthy and attuned system within an individual and a healthy and attuned system between individuals, whether it's two people or 200,000. So we're grounding ourselves in this work, and I am so excited to chat with you more today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So this is such, I love systems work. I mean, these are kind of my favorite interviews that I get to get into. But what brought you to this such broad yet interconnected approach to health and well-being?
Would it sound a little bit too out there to say, I think I was born into it, I was fated to do it. You know, I am an adopted Asian woman, Asian American woman. And so, I was born in, Seoul, Korea, and I was for the first 8 months of my life, I was in an orphanage and a foster family. And then before I was adopted into America, then my parents moved me over into Germany, where they were teachers for the military kids. And so now I'm like essentially a third culture kid being raised in Europe during the Cold War. You know, so we were in West Germany. And it wasn't until my later years that I got back to the States again. So in it kind of inherent in my early childhood is this feeling of being born to integrate, of crossing the East and the West. And really, as far as I've always remembered, I had this fascination between science and spirituality. And my parents had grown up with different religions, and so we didn't practice any particular type of religion. And they had always told me, well, you can choose for yourself. And so I went to all the different churches with all my friends, you know, and all their different religions, and got this really broad perspective of spirituality, and then also of a scientific household, which is what I was raised in. And then later when I was in college, my grandmother taught me transcendental meditation, and I watched it change my brain biochemistry from like having moods that went kind of up and down like this, and to just this really even keeled. And so I got fascinated in neuroscience and meditation. And so it just kept becoming a more and more refined approach to integration. East meets West, healing modalities, science meets spirituality, and cross-cultural dynamics.
I love that. I love all these places where it's like Literally, yes, you're born to integrate. I mean, look at all of the, even within in the household in which you're adopted, the mixed religion and having this openness to faith. It strikes me a lot of my own path growing up in a mixed religious household and having all of these different perspectives. And it really becomes a gift to have this, such variety existing within your world, because you do see what is different, but there is a golden thread that kind of starts tying us through, even in what I think is too often argued as the most disparate things, spirituality and science, right. When really, you know, to me, spirituality is what science has yet to prove, and science is, can be spirit at its most honest form. I think the words are getting away from me there.
One of my favorite quotes, and you know, we all have these childhood books that influence us. And my childhood book was by Madeleine L'Engle, which if the most familiar book of hers is A Wrinkle in Time, but the book that really influenced me is called A Ring of Endless Light. And you know, growing up an only child in a foreign country, I had a lot of time to read books. But one of the things that she quotes in that book is, I forget who originally spoke this or wrote this, but that today's like quantum physicists are our modern day mystics.
Oh, I love that.
And that stayed with me.
Yeah. And I don't know as much about quantum physics as I would like to, but what I do understand is that it is the mysticism of what we can't explain. It's the ghost in the machine, yet it's there and it's backed by the science they can do, but it is mysterious in and of itself. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, mystery in many ways drives science, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, science without questioning, science without the ability to prod and ask mystery and ask question, is propaganda. It becomes dogma in and of itself. But science with question and the unknown and the mystery, you know, again, that is the true form that we are meant to look for. So this born to integrate idea and looking at the well-being of culture and community and the individual, what did your life path of doing all of this integration, where does that come to helping with these organizations and relational interactions?
Yeah. For better or worse, you know, this insatiable desire to continue to learn and integrate more led me to also, let me just add in that a lot of this was driven from my own healing journey, from my own need to fill in the gaps from my early childhood development, you know, the things that got missed when I was in the orphanage. And if you think about, so any attachment expert will tell you that those first, you know, 0 to 8 months are the most critical. And that was what was most disrupted for me. And so much of this has been driven by my feeling on the outside, looking in, like, I know there's something more to feel, you know, but I don't know what it is. And yeah. And so, you know, I think maybe it was After learning the, you know, transcendental meditation, feeling the shift in my brain biochemistry and changing my major to neuropsychology, I just happened to luck out and have a professor at a very conservative university. I went to Texas A&M for my undergrad, but I just happened to have a professor who was a visiting professor for Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. Yeah. And so, you know, in the late 90s, there were only two schools that offered a master's in meditation psychology at that time. And Naropa was one of them. So I did my graduate work there. And then, like most grad students, afterwards went to work in group homes, worked for the city with, you know, mental health centers. And I was faced with people who had more like ongoing intergenerational trauma, oppressed with systems. I worked within these, you know, social service systems, and I could see how the system itself just kind of kept people trapped in many ways. And not just the like governmental system, but just their physical health symptoms, their intergenerational, you know, inherited systems. And, you know, as I was doing that for a little brief period of time, I was like, I'm going to develop something called martial arts psychotherapy. That sounds amazing. And then I realized that it was a pretty big liability for somebody like me who's like 5'1" and 110 pounds, like holding a kick bat for like an angry 200 pound teenage boy. And yeah, you know, so I was like, A, no one's going to insure that. B, it was a little intense. And knew that movement had to be a part of moving trauma energy. And this is, you know, well before psychology and yoga, you know, was a huge thing. And before we really had popularized, you know, trauma-informed movements and things like that. And I went to a yoga class, and it was one of those hot, sweaty, loud music ones. And it was my first one. And I think my friend had drugged me there after a breakup, and she was like, you're just going to love it. And I cried throughout the whole thing, but nobody could tell because I was so sweaty. And it was the most cathartic thing that I'd experienced. And so I was like, aha, this is incredible. And so I started pairing that with my psychotherapy practice, and I called it yoga psychotherapy. And I thought it was really novel and new. And from there, you know, that evolved into, you know, a few years later, I was like, my friend Lisa Wimberger, who is how you got connected with me, she had just started the Neurosculpting Institute. And I was like, you know, I facilitate people all the time. I want something facilitated for me. And so I went, and it was such a profound experience that, of course, then I was like, wow, I have to integrate this into my practice. And so I started playing with integrating yoga and neurosculpting and psychotherapy and meditation. And it evolved into this experience of helping people rewire their bodies and their systems. And I think that, you know, and then that also led to later, you know, there's a few more modalities that I won't go into, but what it led to was like a deep awareness of not just how our own internal system interacts with health and makes everything so much more possible, but also how our, I'm going to overgeneralize for all the like really pure neuroscientists out there, and overgeneralize, and how, you know, things are different between our right and our left hemisphere of our brain. Like when we operate more from an emotional space or more from an abstract space, and when we operate from a more linear space. And this also applies to both, again, an overgeneralization, masculine born body brains and feminine born body brains, and how those interact. And then from that space, I got to see, okay, these big divides that we have systemically aren't necessarily divides in values, but oftentimes are divides in people who operate more from one side of their brain than the other. And it's not that either are particularly wrong. It's just often that they have incomplete information.
Mm-hmm. And over-dominant when we have two hemispheres of our brain that are cross-connected, mm-hmm. and are meant to work in concert with each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we see how too much, you know, it's an age old adage, too much of one thing is not necessarily better, when we need to find that sweet spot, that Goldilocks moment in the middle.
Right. Yeah. The integration of it all. There's this, you know, medical biological definition of toxicity, which I really love. And toxicity, you know, like anything can be medicine, but medicine in too much amount or the wrong is toxic to the human system. Right. And I think about like a lot of the cultural things that are happening that we describe as toxic. And it's not that they are inherently bad, but they're like not in the right place, or mm-hmm. they're out of proportion often. And so when we look at like, you know, the integration of systems, we have to look at, is it in the right place?
Yeah.
Is there in the right amount?
Well, thank you for calling that out. I think it's such an important thing, especially because I feel like the language of the last few years, and even, you know, the last decade kind of at this point, it's not so much about dosing or appropriate placement. It's right or wrong. Throw the baby out with the bathwater. This no longer serves us. Let it fall apart. Let it, get rid of it. This is the problem. And what you're really calling attention to is that, you know, there is no right and wrong. There is what works and what doesn't. And when we start thinking about things in those terms, we have a lot of nuance to engage with about this doesn't work, but why? And now we're back to that mysticism of question and curiosity. So I'm going to...
Okay.
No, go ahead. I can pin.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to like bring it full circle. So there's this interesting phenomena in mammals where the so if you think about survival, like what is most useful for a like female mammal to survive, it's to have lots of babies, like the genetic lineage, right? Mm-hmm. Is to have lots of multiple babies or multiple pregnancies. And on a purely biological level, what is, you know, needed for the masculine lineage to survive is lots of, you know, lots of babies and pregnancies, right? Inseminating mm-hmm. lots of, you know, and growing bigger and stronger, mm-hmm. right? Because the strongest, you know, masculine mammal usually survives. So in the sperm is a growth hormone that basically makes the fetus grow and grow and grow. In the uterus is a growth and almost like an anti-growth hormone that suppresses the growth, right? Because if the masculine sperm were, you know, masculine genetic material were allowed to grow and grow and grow, it would damage the uterus. And then mm-hmm. that female lineage would only be able to have one pregnancy, right? Mm-hmm. But if it was super suppressed, then the male wouldn't grow to be very big or strong. And so there's this dance, even for the very like smallest component of integration between checks and balances of growth forward and nurturing and sustainability. And I think about that in terms of our human evolution. We've been in this place of survival where a lot of the growth forward has happened. We've grown and grown, and the masculine has been dominant. And we've reached a place where, okay, good, we've survived. It's clear we've got lots of people on the earth. But now look, the earth isn't doing so well. She's, you know, in essence, our womb. So we need to come back and bring more of the feminine essence in for more sustainability. And so I love this just big systemic circle that stems from the purest, like almost simplest part, which is our conception, mm-hmm. right? The human health body conception.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love the imagery, the whole idea of needing that balance and that check. And again, we're not getting into the right and wrong of masculine is terrible. Let's get rid of all that. It's had its time in the sun, forget it. But now just so much that we've been out of balance and we're mm-hmm. about to have this like alien explosion through the womb of an overgrown yeah. fetus versus... like, can we nurture this so that yeah. our planet, so our system, our community can continue on and support more generations? Because right. that's what we need.
Oh. Yeah. So I just feel like there's this microcosmic, you know, thing that happens in this fractal, if you will, this, mm-hmm. And it gets to ripple out. And so from that lens is how I can look at whether it's just within a human or within a political system or something mm-hmm. and see what is the information that needs to be communicated? What's out of proportion?
And that actually brings me to what I was going to ask. And I'm glad we went in this order because you set it up so beautifully is, you know, at the beginning, you talked about the systems that kept people trapped and how it wasn't just the political system that they were in or just the economic or just the health or just the ancestral. You know, we have all kinds of different systems. And so what I'm going to ask is that if you'll take us on a little journey here from understanding these symptoms, maybe in like the Cliff Notes version, so that we can then move towards a appreciation of finding that balance between, again, the oversimplified, but now very accessible right versus left brain, emotional versus linear kind of approach to things. And I'll throw my apology into the ring as well for our purists. We're going to go for broad strokes here today.
Yeah. So, you know, because we're talking about health and healing, let's start there. Let's start with like just the health of the physical body. So, you know, our system is so smart. It's really designed to repair itself. We've got all the things that we need in our encoded material. Whether it's turned on or not is a different story, but we do have the encoding to counter most of what comes into our field. What happens when we can't, when we get sick, stay sick, get sick repetitively, is that there's often too much of something, right? Mm-hmm. And how does our body respond as inflammation? And there's too much of something that prevents something else from coming online, turning on to do the thing that it needs to do. And we don't have for all intents and purposes, we could in theory heal ourselves, but could we take 3 years or 4 years or 5 years off in a completely nurtured environment to do that? Our system isn't really set up like that. You know, mm-hmm. An animal in the wild, when they get injured, they'll go sleep under a bush for like 4 days, literally just sleep for four days, not, and then they're healed enough for the most part. Mm-hmm. But when we get sick, I mean, I don't know about you, but like, I'm still answering emails. I'm still handling life, you know, and things like that, unless I'm just really, really sick.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's kind of, as we look at what illness is in the last 2 years, you know, since the pandemic began, as I've always thought that one of the better gifts of this experience we've had in the last 2 years is it's the first time that really, without exception, if you're sick, you stay home. Mm-hmm. And that is such an abrupt departure, at least mm-hmm. from the American. You know, I have to really just speak to the American version because that's what I know. But I'm assuming right. There are other places that might be similar. The abrupt departure of, oh, you're not dead. Okay, we'll see you in 10.
Yeah.
And what does that really allow our body to do and care for?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have arranged my life very intentionally so that I can take large amounts of time for self-care. But part of that stems from, I won't say that I never felt well, but, you know, to some degree, I, you know, could be thrown in the failure to thrive category. And so my levels of energy were never what I thought they could be. And so because of that, I had to arrange my life so that I could have more time to rest, yeah. to do all of those things. And so now that I have brought my energy levels up to, you know, what I think normal might be, is that I already have the conditions built into my life that I can take massive amounts of time to rest and heal. But that is a very, very privileged, even if it wasn't born out of privilege, it's still a very privileged place to be. And our system, you know, our work system, our government system is not set up that is the case. And I think about, you know, even the fact that I don't work a 9-to-5, if I have to go to the doctor or something like that, or if I had to take a child to the doctor, I don't have to take time off work. Mm-hmm. We have a system set up that if you're sick or if you need to do anything preventative, you have to take time off work. And if you take time off work and you happen to work a, you know, minimum wage job, oftentimes you're docked for that. Mm-hmm. And so there's this systemic, you know, sort of entrapment that happens. And then even food, you know, I'm just hitting all of the big 10 here. food is, there's a lot of influence that goes into what healthy means. Mm-hmm. And that influence is often from companies who produce these other things, you know, other things that I don't consider food. Yeah. And so it's harder for people who don't have that privileged information to have the time to make the food, to get the, you know, healthy food, the things that aren't going to cause inflammation and long-term
detriment,
things that your body has to spend more energy on. Mm-hmm. And it's not that these things are just inherently terrible, but if your body has to spend more energy processing the gunk out, that's less energy your body has to heal yourself.
Mm-hmm. And to speak then of the system, that's the stuff that is government subsidized. That's the corn and the high fructose syrup and all of these things that makes a bag of Cheetos cost less than an apple. Mm-hmm. And I would really hope at least our listeners tuning in are going to know which one of those is the healthy choice. but it's not the most affordable choice. And you can certainly see how systemically when you are on a tight financial budget and you've been, you know, in a compromised health situation. And so maybe there are appointments that you have to go to and doctor's visits. And if you're in a 9-to-5 or a, you know, hourly paycheck, now you're losing money to go take care of your health, to be asked to spend more money and more time to make healthier foods. Mm-hmm. It becomes this backlogged mm-hmm. place of effort. And then as you and I both know, when you're in compromised health, your energy level to do all of those things to take care of that backlog is part of that system of what doing the best you can, and the best you can sometimes keeps you stuck.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so interesting, just on the food piece for a moment. I got to be intimately involved in the first 5 years of this incredible child's life. And I was like, this is the most amazing child ever. You know, his behavior was like attuned and connected, like all the toddler things that people talked about, you know, we never ever dealt with. And, you know, he also was very privileged, had lots of attention, lots of attunement, lots of the top food, and all, even in his, you know, prenatal times. But what was interesting is every once in a while, like, he'd go to a birthday party or something like that and eat the things that, you know, normal, you know, kids eat, mm-hmm. like cupcakes or Cheetos or whatever. And he would come back and his behavior would be like typical toddlers. Mm-hmm. And these things that we just take for granted are like, oh, those are toddlers. And they don't actually need to be that way.
And I think it's sort of a moment of seeing the forest for the trees. And I will admit that I am 100% biased, because the toddler that I'm going to use on example, I happen to give birth to. I have people agreeing with me that she is lovely. You know, I did very similarly to what you did in that self-care and healthcare were not optional. And I orchestrated my whole life around being able to take care of myself and make sure that my health was as good as I could get it. And, you know, as of last summer, I think I too was getting close to what normal good energy could be. It was really fun. I like it. I'm going to keep going for it. But I am really, for that reason, very particular about what I feed my daughter. And even when she was gestating, when I was pregnant, I made choices about leaving a very stressful work environment so as not to bathe her in cortisol for her whole intrauterine life. All of this comes from the privilege of my choices and my upbringing, I know. And she is such a calm, well-behaved, easygoing kid. And same thing, birthday parties, you know, Christmas treats. We just celebrated Halloween. And I just know that my kid disappears into a sugar craze or a crash for an afternoon, an evening. She gets sick, the snot starts flowing more. And when you have come from a place of health, you can see the impact of some of falling into these systemic choices. But when you are in the flow of these systemic choices, like you were saying, it is all normal. It is all to be expected. And if that's your baseline, that also impacts the energy to try and get away from it, yeah?
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because, you know, our systems don't like to change. And our brain, from a survival place, actually, I'm sure you know this, actually rewards us for not changing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you think about the caveman days before we had Wikipedia and could look up, hey, that berry is a different color, let me just check and see if it's still, you know, going to be healthy or not. The brain actually needed to tell us, yo, don't try those like purple colored, you know, berries with green spots. So we get a bigger hit of dopamine for not changing than we do for changing. And so it takes extra energy for us to go against that, and extra feel good power to go against what this brain is trying to tell us, you know, not to do. And if we're already tired or stressed, or our body system doesn't have enough, then we're not going to have that extra energy to make that change. And that's one of the things that I found was really potent about neurosculpting and the practice of neurosculpting specifically, which, you know, for the listeners, is it's a guided meditation, but it's so much more than that. It's really a life practice. It's a way of supporting your system for enhanced neuroplasticity, meaning supporting your system so that you can continue to grow and make new neural pathways and make the changes that you want and make that change sustainable. And one of the great outcomes of neurosculpting specifically is it's regularly, like if you're doing the meditations, helping your brain down regulate to a feeling of safety where you have more capacity to A, create the new neural pathways, and B, feel like you have power to change as well.
And that is such a beautiful, I almost would call it a cheat code, because it really does, you're kind of getting away with something, is that, you know, rather than, and I'm going to get lost in here, but like putting the cart before the horse, almost, to say that you are, you know, you look around, you acknowledge the system you're in, you're working 9 to 5, paycheck to paycheck. There is a lot of health choices and a lot of food choices and things that just are what they are. And this is baseline. And we are just going to now, instead of saying good or bad, acknowledge it for what it is. And knowing what we know about our neurology, to say that you need to somehow come up with the energy to change your food choices and come up with the food to change your accessibility, or come up with the money to change your accessibility to these food choices, like, this looks like climbing Everest. And I'm sure that when people are trying to look at healthcare choices, it looks like freaking Everest every time. But now we throw in that cheat code of neurosculpting and meditation and tricking, changing, molding the brain into a place where that you have that energy to make the change rather than making change to get the energy. That makes sense.
Absolutely. And I want to, you know, just backpedal a little bit and say, you know, it's not that you have to feed your kids or you have to feed yourself these like uber healthy things. Yeah. It's more a question again of proportionality. Like if you have a high load of stress and a high load of junk in your body and a high load of, you know, relational like discord, all of these things, that's a lot for your body to handle, you mm-hmm. know? And so neurosculpting is really giving you the choice and the agency of where do I want to, you know, carve through this? Mm-hmm. I love my bagels with cream cheese, and I'm even gluten-free, but you know, every once in a while I'll still do bagels with cream cheese, like specifically everything bagels slathered mm-hmm. with lots of butter and then cream cheese, even though gluten hurts my belly a little bit. But I'll take it because I've cleaned out a bunch of other stuff in my system. And so it's not great, but I can my body can handle, I can handle it. It's not much detriment.
It's coming back to the medical definition of toxicity. You know, I think that there are a lot of health and wellness gurus out there with the message of pristine, like your body is a temple, like that kind of pristine, do it perfectly. And that's a lovely beacon of light. That would be awesome if we were surrounded, and I really believe that we were surrounded by all the tools to attend to our temple. But the fact of the matter is that our bodies are meant to handle challenge and to handle a little bit of stress. And so we're not really looking at that perfection, but I just wanted to highlight back to the point that you made earlier of it's about what kind of balance are we in? And where are you choosing to cut the stress? So if you are in a stress bucket of interrelational stress and work stress and food stress and health stress, pick one corner of your temple to clean.
Yeah. And I think that's a thing that often gets missed, you know, in the health guru mm-hmm. arena, is you can be physically really healthy in terms of what you're putting in your body and the sensitivities of your body. Mm-hmm. But what about your thoughts? You know, like, are you attacking your health with a degree of aggression and rigidity? Because if you are, that is creating about as much toxicity as if you were to go have, you know, a bag of Skittles before bed. It's mm-hmm. just in terms of what your system has to has to balance out.
Mm-hmm. Just asking for gentleness in a way, gentleness with choices, but also trying to resource ourselves well.
Yeah.
So, I love this balance that you're bringing to the conversation, this understanding of humanity and what we can control, what's outside of our control, what our choices are, and where that sits in this ability to do things like meditation and neurosculpting. And we did, just to call out to any of our long-term listeners, we did do an interview with about neurosculpting with Mariah Ellert. This was back in the middle of the, she's from your community, as I understand it. Back in the middle of quarantine pandemic. And so a lot of really rich examples of how to work with your brain and neurosculpt what you can control in your own home, when really at that time, you know, in the spring of 2020, that was our sphere of influence, you know, often the four walls in which we lived. So really great episode. If it's not going to be stressful or triggering for anybody to go back to spring of 2020, I highly recommend it. But another reason why we're having this conversation again is let's just have it outside of that. Let's talk about then this idea of neurosculpting and finding that really resiliency and strength within our own neurobiology. And with that, coming to this understanding of right brain versus left brain, because as I understand it, and I'd love to hear more from you on it, you know, a lot of like fear thinking and stress and limited resources and all of those aspects of life, which are very real, but they drive our left brain because it's a very linear problem solving. How do I deal with scarcity? How do I survive? And then that right brain, that emotional interconnected piece, is more about a broader sense of problem solving, but there's a little bit of foundational stacking that has to happen as we try and access these two different parts of our brain. So let me know if I'm totally off base or, you know.
You're not totally off base, and I'm just going to bring a little nuance to it. So if you think about these very, again, overgeneralized pictures, but I'm sure you've seen like the memes where the left brain is like this like maze or labyrinth, and the right brain is like this like, you know, Jackson Pollock of colors. And so a way to think about it would be, you know, right brain sort of centering on that which is abstract, like, you know, like the blending of things, the dissolving of boundaries. It's one of the reasons why people like specific types of psychedelic medicines, because there's a like dissolving of boundaries. And you know, you've seen the probably the memes of people being on some kind of substance and being like, "I love you, man." It's the dissolving of these walls, whereas the maze has all these walls. It's very linear, and it's not that one is a love fest and the other one isn't. It's more about the dissolving of the boundaries, or the, you know, presence of the boundaries. And so then you've got the front brain, the executive brain, and then the more midbrain. And that's where we talk about fear versus the executive thinking. And so you can be both very logical in your left brain and in the front of your brain too. And you can also be very connected in the front of your brain, or you can be in a lot of fear in both sides. And so one of the practices of neurosculpting is that as a meditation modality, it actually ping-pongs back and forth between your right hemisphere and your left hemisphere, and engages both, both hemispheres, the integration of both hemispheres, as well as the somatic, the body component. And, you know, so we know that, of course, when you're doing something and you're using more parts of your brain and body, you're actually, just by simple math, you know, using more, you know, neural pathways. And so you're more likely for that to embed in your practice. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to wire it all together. And so much of, if we were to look at our brain, you know, going online and even just Googling homunculus and seeing these pieces, we see what large sections of the squishy matter of our brain is derived from how we move and how we feel our body. Mm-hmm. And so integrating our thoughts into that just runs those pathways in a way that now you're enacting you know, what's swimming around in your head so often.
Absolutely. And, you know, meditation in its most traditional form is pretty right hemispheric activating, meaning most meditations you see, if you put the like little sucker cups, I forget what they're called, you know, on your brain.
No, EKG's hard. Anyway, sucker cups on your brain. We're going to go with that.
You know, you see like a lot of activation, you know, and I'm talking about the, you know, Buddhist versions, the, you know, these long-term meditation practices. Now, if you engage neurosculpting, though, then you're getting both. You're getting the integration between the right and the left. And, you know, that's, of course, when we talk about systems, integrating, you know, is what brings us more towards wholeness. Mm-hmm. And the more we can do that to actually be able to not just have the feeling, but also the story and mm-hmm. have them be integrated versus separate, then that allows us to, you know, instead of just being mad because he's saying something different, being able to like be in my feeling and actually understand, or be something that's super logical and not understanding why they're so emotional, you know, mm-hmm. but like actually being able to understand their emotional, because now I can actually integrate my right hemisphere and my left hemisphere.
And I love the two examples that you were just sort of giving, and maybe to asking you to expand on them, is to take this idea of toxicity as you defined it, the overdosing. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the overdosing of the linear of the maze and the overdosing of the emotional, what do we miss out if we're hanging out too deeply in either one of those camps?
You know, I'm just, again, going to take these overgeneralizations, and you may know somebody who is never on time, can't remember to pay their bills, super like maybe really kind-hearted, but they're just not quite all there is what it feels like. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say that they're missing out on some of the just more foundational aspects of living in this physical world. Mm-hmm. Right? And I always think, well, you know, I love living up in these like etheric realms, and my body is here in this world, and I have to interact, you know, in this world. So I want to also be adept in this physical realm here. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the extreme end of operating primarily from the left, you know, side of the very, very logical, is not being able to really understand what makes, you know, the relational component tick, or why people are upset about something. And, you know, if you can't understand why people are upset about something and take that into account, you're in just as much of a denial of reality as the person who is up in la la land. You know, there's just, both realities exist in our, you know, in our divine being experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are made of the physical, and we have this incredible gift of the creative and the interconnection. And you do have to find where we can hold both of them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you can do an integration and become, you know, more of a whole being, like, and not to say that, you know, you're not whole at all. You're whole, but like awareness of your whole wholeness. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You know, that in that integration allows for a sense of safety, right? Mm-hmm. And when you have a sense of safety in the nervous system, or just in general, you have more of a likelihood to be in play. Right, to experience the things that come as like, oh, what a great adventure, versus, oh God, that's, you know, that's different. And when we're in a sense of play and the world is an adventure, then we're more likely to try new things and have different experiences. Mm-hmm. And when we're having different experiences and we're able to see things from other people's perspectives, we're able to again, have a broader perspective. And that comes back into policy and policymakers, and, you know, so helping, you know, with the nervous system for people to feel integrated and create a more broad perspective based policy that will actually include, you know, all the people that people are making policy for.
Oh, not just like a small sliver.
Yeah. This works for me. Why doesn't this work for you?
Yeah. But that, wow, you just said a mouthful. But that whole idea of this works for me, why doesn't this work for you? That is exactly, you know, the two separate sides of the brain that, as you just detailed them. Like, this is so emotional and huggy. Why don't you get it? Or, you know, this solves a problem. What's your problem that you don't get to see people and talk? But why don't you get it? And it is that being on guard. And I've never heard it put this way. And it just made me smile, the being in play. And when I first, when you first said it, I was thinking like, you know, the ball's in play, like now you can be part of the action, which I think you had double entendre going there, that is very much what you mean, but also that when you're in play in that joyous place of like watching children interact and, you know, you watch, go to a, I mean, don't be creepy about it, but if you go to a schoolyard and you're seeing kids, this could go wrong, but you watch children, they just like swarm. There is sort of an innate flow of this, you know, group of like 20 kids, and they swarm and they interact and they engage, and it is organic and it's moving and all the kids are involved. And maybe they're not all happy all at the same time or for the whole thing, but they are all involved and all happy throughout the play. And that level of imagining your brain being in play like that, being in the game and part of this organic swarm, just feels so much more limitless and inviting than on guard, I have fixed this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for that language. That lit up my brain. So for anybody who is listening and then they want to learn more about neuroplasticity, I know we didn't I didn't ask you to come prepared, but I am curious if there is a way to get started. You know, we talk about integrating our brains. Is there a way of being within ourselves or being with our breath that we might get curious about the idea of neurosculpting and bringing our two brains into balance, into play with each other?
Yeah, well, I mean, excuse me. I think the, simplest thing would just be to go to the neurosculpting website, which is neurosculpting.com. There's a host of different types of information on there currently. And by currently, I mean, you know, because I'm sure this will play farther into time, but currently I mean November of 2021. It's November now. We have a really incredible intern who is pairing psychotherapy and neurosculpting, what I used to do when I saw more clients. And he's pairing psychotherapy and neurosculpting and works on a sliding scale. So that is a profound opportunity to take advantage of for this year and the, you know, first half of 2022. But otherwise, there's a lot of on-demand options. There are live classes that people can take. And then one of the relationship experts that I love, because again, you know, to me, this is all about relationship with self, but also relationship with other. Mm-hmm. One of the relationship experts I love has an audiobook called Your Brain on Love, The Neurobiology of Healthy, I'm going to say relationship, it could be attachment, but I think it's relationship. And his name is Stan Tatkin, Tatkin. That one's only an audiobook, at least the last time I checked. And he's got, you know, a lot of other things, but this one's really the best one. And it's a super easy listen. So I think anybody who's in relationship should mm-hmm. read that one as well. So, I mean, as far as like entry points into neuroplasticity, those are my top recommendations.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much for the resources. And definitely we will link the neurosculpting website below in the show notes. And then if we can find Mr. Totkin's book, we'll throw that in there as well. But I think we're in a real opportunity and a turning point to look at the boundaries of rigidity in our own lives and our own world, and not necessarily have to accept them for the system they have been and we have been in. We can always thank the systems of our past for getting us to where we are. But if where we are feels incomplete or out of balance, then it is the invitation to learn something new and to change our dosing in some ways, to change the toxicity in our lives.
I actually have one exercise to give you. I'm not sure where I learned this. I might've actually learned this directly from Lisa herself. So if you find yourself going down this emotional road or this story road, so whether you're feeling just angry and you don't know why, or upset and you don't know why, or you're in the story of like, and then they did this and they did this and they did this and they did this, right? You're just really stuck in a thought process. This exercise hits both your, engages the cross hemispheric communication between your right and your left. So you ready? Put your hands up.
Right, I'll do it with you.
Okay. And then you're going to take your index finger and your thumb on one hand, and then your thumb and your pinky finger on the other hand. I've got double jointed fingers, so it's a little bit weird. And then you're going to slowly go dun, dun,
oy,
dun, so that you end up. Yep. And then you do it a little bit faster. And then you keep going.
Oh, gee, I got messed up.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Okay. Oh, man. Despite feeling annoyed about how hard this is, I also feel calmer. Is that weird? Is that?
No, not at all. Not at all. I know it's a little bit like what? Cause, and you know, we're in this kind of joyful experience of conversation, but if you're really upset about something one way or the other, it's kind of like, like kicks you out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not that whatever's going, you know, wrong will change, but that it helps your brain become more integrated so that you can make some different choices in that moment if you want.
Because absolutely, if you're in this emotional anger and you're lost in that boil and you can't see clearly for the water that's not steady,
mm-hmm.
or you're in this and then this angry talk through, there's no solution in either of those,
mm-hmm.
in whichever one you're on. And as I was doing this exercise, which this might be my new favorite thing, is that I am physically shifting my eyes back and forward to look at both hands, and trying to coordinate them, which mm-hmm. we know from neurology and integrating the brain that eye movement is what, and we have some functional neurology podcasts where we go deep into that. So this is just like the teaser for our entire catalog. Go find functional neurology, go find Mariah. But that's what lights up different cortices of our brain and integrates across body. So you've got your neck moving, you've got your eyes moving, and then you've got coordination, which also lights up the cerebellum and tags into the brainstem of emotional control. We got it all. This is amazing and really hard. And I really invite, if you're driving, please don't do this, but then stop driving and give it a shot. This is such a cool exercise. Thank you. Oh, I love
it. You're welcome. You're welcome. You know, so just to like loop it all back together, the health of our own body system, right? Our ability to make some different choices when we're activated is impacted by the physical health that we have access to, by the system, by the everything, just like a city system is impacted by the power, the water, the, you know, the nutrition available, the health of the brain, AKA the mayor or the, you know, whoever. And so we've got this microcosm and then this macrocosm, this reflection of if we can learn to really work in our own self with all the integrating parts and find the proportional algorithms that work for us, we can start to translate that into our, you know, greater work in the world.
I love that. It speaks so cleanly to the fractal that you were talking about in mm-hmm. us and the womb of the earth, or the conception in the womb of the mother. We are nothing but a mirror of everything that comes broader and wider. And how can you expect an individual who is thinking, you know, so linearly or so ethereally to have anything other than those solutions when building a city, when thinking about waste management, when thinking about feeding the people? You know, we are the engines of those choices. So how do we want to take care of ourselves? Just absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Arlie, I so enjoyed this conversation today. I hope our listeners got a lot out of it. I definitely did. My brain is swimming with all of the imagery that you've created. And I imagine that it is no mistake that you use such vibrant imagery when we're talking about sculpting, changing our brain. I think you're being sneaky on many levels. But this is so thank you so much. We will link all of these resources in the show notes. Thank you again. I'm just going to keep saying thank you till I sign off.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So to all of our listeners, I hope that you got a little something to apply to your life throughout this week. Of course, you know, it's always nice to absorb new ideas and hear new concepts around health. But until we start applying it in our day-to-day, it is nothing but an idea out in the podcast world. So take some of this home with you, try it in your own life, let us know how it goes. And we'll see you next week for another episode of the Healing Ground Movement podcast. Be well.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed what you heard and got a little something out of it. Now remember, the information expressed in these interviews is for informational and not diagnostic or treatment purposes. However, I hope you find that having the right information and resources can go a long way to helping you on your healthcare journey. Ask the right questions and seek out professional help.